essentially we knew what the problem was and we knew what we needed in order to solve it, but it was the critical clone, the critical reagent was not at hand. So the first 6, 7, or 8 months was a very uncomfortable time of working very hard, trying a number of different approaches, some of which were utter failures, knowing that there was hot competition from the other laboratories, which was always a big consideration. You want to be the first to clone it. You don't want to read about it in Nature. And essentially that was a great time, but it was also a very tough time because we didn't know if we were ever going to get it. And around Christmas time, in fact, we got a clone, which turned out to be the right thing. And that actually was the critical break point. After that time, everything went very quickly. We worked harder than ever, but it was very clear what to do, and everything went very smoothly. Before that time, we had no real sense that we would actually succeed. And the one thing I remember quite distinctly was we were not alone doing this. There were several other groups working on it. We got a clone which we thought was the right thing, and another group at Harvard also got a clone that they thought was the right thing. And we actually arranged to exchange clones, and John Seidman, the lab director, while it was competitive, it was not hostile. There was a lot of good feeling and a lot of exchange of information. And I distinctly remember that one of the people from that group was coming to the NIH to give a seminar and was bringing with him the clone. We, of course, very much wanted their clone to see what it was. And he walked into the lab and with John, and they were discussing, he was getting ready for the talk in a very relaxed way. And I remember he said, "Oh yes, I happen to have a clone here," handed it to me, and walked out, and I immediately put it into the ice bucket, had everything set, ready to analyze it. Within 5 minutes, it was transformed in bacteria. And the next one day or 2 days later was Christmas Day, where one of the few times I'd gone into the lab on Christmas Day, pulled out the clones and began the analysis. And it turned out, in fact, to be right. But to show you the kind of mindset into which one gets oneself. And after that time, after Christmas, the beginning of the year, everything went very smoothly, very quickly, and I think we wrote 3 or 4 papers within the next 6 months to a year.
So that really put this little group and you on the map.
Exactly. It was that
this that was in your first year?
This was in the first year of my postdoctoral fellowship. Again, the period of time that I spent at the NIH was divided into 2 halves. And the first 2 years, I was in this group of people working after our initial clone very intensely on various aspects. And the group got bigger. There were other people that came that were working on other projects, not directly related to this. But about a year after I arrived, it was announced to all of us that Phil Leder had been offered and accepted the job of the chairmanship of genetics at Harvard, and he was leaving the NIH. And John Seidman announced that he had been offered a position there and was leaving also. And of course, everyone was all up. Some of the people that had come a few weeks before that announcement were quite upset because they were going to have to move again. And from my point of view, I was offered a position there in John's new lab. But because I'd already been there 2 years and was really considering after the 3rd year of going on and finding my own job rather than staying any longer, I decided to stay at the NIH. And what happened was that the entire department picked up and left. And there were maybe 3 or 4 of us that were the more senior ones that stayed in the same space. And that was actually the best year of the entire experience because I had already learned a great deal. I knew all the techniques. I had all the facilities. And then my boss left, and I was left to myself. And it was great fun to actually run my own lab for the first time. And it was just me and another postdoc who was working on his project. But actually, most of the things that I was most proud of and found I thought were the most creative were done during that time. And at that time, I was then looking at jobs in various places, deciding where to go.
Was staying at NIH a real option?
Yes, I was offered a position as a equivalent of assistant professor at the NIH in the new laboratory of molecular genetics, which was being reorganized after Phil Leder and his group left. And at the same time, I applied to a number of other places. I was recruited by the Salk Institute in part because I knew a number of people here from having been here before, and my thesis advisor, Jeff Rosenfeld, was at that time actually here at the Institute and was lobbying very hard to have them recruit me back. And so at that time, the real decision came, would I stay at the NIH or would I move and come to the Salk Institute? And that was another very difficult decision to know which was the right thing to do.
What, talk about that.
Well, the things I think that influenced me were partly not so much the Salk Institute, which I knew very well and had been at, but things changed so much at the NIH, at least in the building that I was in, because I was in the midst of this incredibly exciting, vibrant group of two dozen people exactly like myself, very enthusiastic, energetic, very bright people, and it picked up and left. And while it was fun to remain behind, it was also a void, and it was not as exciting, it was not as much fun to interact with the people next door because they weren't there anymore. There were new people coming in, but I wasn't sure what that group was going to be like. I knew who the new lab director was and someone I respect very much, but not quite in the same way. And in some ways, I was looking to where I wanted to be, who my next door neighbors were going to be, what my lab was going to be set up like. And I saw the two as fairly equivalent from an intellectual point of view. From a practical point of view, there are a lot of differences. The NIH is all internal funding, so you didn't have to write grants. On the other hand, your group was only as large as you could convince the administrative structure it should be. Whereas here, well, no one, you're essentially entirely on your own in terms of funding. You have freedom to do whatever you want. It's a very intellectually free area, and if you can write the grant to do it, you can do the experiment, which was somewhat different than the NIH. So I think they're very different places. This is also an extremely small institute, and the NIH, of course, is very large.
Is there a problem with being small?
As far as the institute, I think it has very great advantages, and that's my own bias, in that a small place has the potential of being extremely efficient in how it does things. And one of the things that is true of the Salk Institute that is not true of the NIH is the support facilities and personnel and purchasing department and photo labs and equipment labs and the building people that renovate lab spaces is incredibly efficient compared with the government or even, I think, a large university like the University of California. So that's a very distinct advantage. And the Institute's philosophy originally was to make a place ideal for doing scientific research. They have lived up to many of those things, I think. Maybe not every promise.
So you chose to come here. How many?
I'd also mention that there were also personal things that you know, my family being in California also had a little bit to do with it. My wife at the time was pregnant, and we were deciding not only where we wanted to live and where I wanted to work, but where we wanted to bring our children up. And I think that also played a big part.
Let me go to Salk for now. Your title was assistant professor, then associate professor. In that sense, how many faculty are there?
There are, I believe, about 36 principal investigators, meaning people with their own labs. There are several other faculty who are have the title of staff scientist, who are faculty but within some other umbrella laboratory.
And do you know what all these people are doing?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the intimate details of exactly what it is, but I'm very interested in a lot of areas that are unrelated to what we do. For instance, one of the faculty members that I actually deal a lot with now, Ursula Belugi, is a neuropsychologist, and she studies American Sign Language. And among the deaf, she also has been working with children that have a disease called Williams Syndrome. Williams Syndrome is a birth defect that leads to mentally retarded children, and they have a very strange looking, they're called pixie children, they have a very strange looking face, but they have more advanced language ability than their peers. So she's very interested in higher cognitive functions, and I would at least like to think about ways that one can apply the kinds of things we know how to do to understanding that. I'm not sure that we have the tools for that particular problem, but I'm very interested in what I have a fair idea of what most of the people here do, but I don't profess to understand it in any great depth. Terry Sanofsky, who is the head of a new laboratory called Computational Neurobiology, works on neural networks, which is a mathematical way of it's actually a part of computer science. It's a way of linking objects to enable them to process information and to learn. So he's using that to make models of how the brain might function. We were actually thinking about how we could use that to solve problems of comparing DNA sequences, because it allows you to write a computer program that can learn in various ways. Whether it can be done, I'm not sure.
So you come to Salk, this is the moment when you have to start funding yourself,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and also deciding what you can do.
Well, both of those, I think, are important considerations. One of the things postdoctoral fellows always get very insecure about is what are they going to do when they go and start their own lab? And the most important thing is, can they take the project they're working on with them? Various labs have different philosophies on that. And one thing that can happen is you end up working on the same thing that you worked on as a postdoc, but now you're in competition with your old advisor rather than in collaboration. The other possibility is you decide to do something completely unrelated and have trouble getting a grant because you have no experience in that area. So Phil Leader's philosophy was always that the postdocs should start something entirely new and shouldn't work on the same thing he was working on, partly for his benefit, partly for their benefit. And he encouraged postdocs, as they're towards the end of their time, to think about other things and actually, you know, do a few experiments on other things before they left. Now, my advisor, John Seidman, and I talked about this with him before leaving to decide what to do, and he was of a similar philosophy that you should really work on whatever you're interested in, whatever you want to, but he's not going to give you your project. He's going to continue to work on it, so it would be somewhat competitive. So essentially what John and I decided is that I would write a grant on whatever I wanted to. He would continue to do whatever he wanted and work on those areas. And if we ended up being competitors, that's okay, but we, you know, maintain good relations. And what actually happened is that I wrote a grant on exactly that, got the grant, and then didn't do anything that I said I was going to do in the grant. I used it to do an entirely new area, and did very well at it. And what really matters to the granting agencies is that you do something interesting and creative along those lines, not that you do exactly what you said you were going to do. And John, on the other hand, got areas of interest in other directions and dropped that project entirely. So, in fact, neither of us ended up doing that, rather than both of us working on the same thing.
Who was the granting agency?
NICHD, Child Health and Human Development. And, in fact, when I wrote the renewal for that grant, what I actually proposed to do was to continue the analysis of some of the same kinds of genes that I had worked on as a postdoc, proposing models of how they might function. What I actually did was I did the same thing on a different class of genes, which we cloned ourselves, and which, you know, we weren't in any competition with. And then what the agency said when they reviewed it was that Dr. Evans did a very clever thing, in that he began to work on one area and realized that wouldn't answer the questions that he wanted to answer, and then applied the same technique to this other set of genes. And I was actually complimented for the fact that I had changed directions, not grossly, but at least redirected things in a way that was primarily what I was more interested in. And I think in the long run, it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And that has actually been a very successful set of experiments.
That was a grant that started up in 83.
Started up in 83. And I wrote that grant actually while I was still at the NIH.
You also had a Keck grant in 83.
I had some funds from the Keck Foundation. That was actually arranged by Max Cowan, who's now the vice president of Howard Hughes, who used to be the scientific director at the Salk Institute. And essentially what happened was, which I remember quite distinctly, was I was here in my own lab, very small, had my first grant, and someone came that wanted to do a postdoctoral fellowship with me, and I said, well, I'd very much like to have you. I don't have any money to pay you, but I'll go ask. And I asked Max, being very naive at the time, didn't realize that one probably doesn't do these things in polite scientific circles, but I asked him if there was any possibility of having funding for a postdoc for a year. And I remember his comments quite distinctly. He said, well, you're from the NIH. Let me show you how fast and efficient things can be done at the Salk Institute. And he picked up the phone, and within 10 minutes, I had a salary for this postdoc, which came from the Keck Foundation.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And indeed, will you talk about the three things, the size of the group you've mm-hmm. had over the years from then till now, the funding of the group, because mm-hmm. I see you've had multiple mm-hmm. funding, and what you've been up to.
Okay. The first thing, the size of the group, until very recently, this was a very small group, which consisted of myself, one postdoctoral fellow, one technician, who was actually Jeff Rosenfeld's wife, my thesis advisor, who has worked for me since I came here, and a number of graduate students. And I very much enjoyed dealing with graduate students. And while there aren't as many students here as there are at the university, there are a few, and I've always gone out of my way to try to attract them. Now, I'm not...
So you've had what, one or two at a time? Or?
Four. I have four now, and I've had...
They're writing a thesis for you.
They're writing a thesis for me. They do all the thesis research.
You have your license to...
No, actually I'm not, but I will be soon, but we've managed to find our way around. The criteria for a student coming here is they have to really want to come here, because it's much more difficult for them than staying at the university. They have to.
So this isn't typical for Salk people either.
It's it's not typical for the senior Salk people. The senior professors all have adjunct appointments. The junior professors, none of them have adjunct appointments, because they don't make those easily anymore. So they're now, I mean, I should have such an appointment as of the first of the year, but so far, during the last year, it has been very difficult, and the students have been selected in that they're willing to go around the system in order to arrange to come here.
It's a little bootlegging operation.
It's very much on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm. So you've really wanted to do it?
Oh, yes. I very much enjoy students. And
what's the value added to you?
Well, there's the practical value, which is really not very much, is that they stay longer than a postdoc. Postdoctoral fellowship is usually 2 years or 3 years. Students is usually 4 years or 5 years. But in actuality, they require such a large amount of attention and training that it really takes them a while before they can work in the lab effectively. The real, I think, value is that I enjoy teaching the students. They're much more willing to think about problems, and they're more willing to do some of the things I would suggest to them than postdocs. Postdocs are very, in general, focused on a particular problem. They want to grind out the work. They want to write the papers and begin looking for jobs. Graduate students are much more intellectual about it, actually. They're much more interested in the science for the science's sake. I find them much more fun to deal with. I think the real reason that there are students here is because I like having graduate students in the lab. So until recently, I've had only one postdoctoral fellow at a time, partly because I haven't, as a young assistant professor without a reputation, you don't have a lot of people knocking on your door. In the last year, for one reason or another, because the work is becoming very visible, there are a lot of people applying all the time. So I've had, it's quite the opposite. I have to pick and choose and be very careful who I have in the lab. And so now there are 8 postdoctoral fellows in addition to the graduate students and a couple more who may be coming. So just in the last year, the group has expanded quite a lot. Part of that is the attention that the work, when the work goes well, a lot of people want to come and help work on it. Partly is the kind of thing we're now beginning to do requires more people than a very small group. It's shifting slightly to something else. As far as funding, the Salk Institute has no internal funding of any kind, so I pay my entire salary myself. I've always been worried about having a single NIH grant supporting you, and then if you lose the grant, you have no funding whatsoever. So it was clear to me from when I originally came that I would have to have at least 2 grants, just so I could split things up that way. And so I have the initial grant, which I wrote before I came. The day I arrived, I started writing the second one, and I've been lucky in that they've been funded both times. And those have really supported the majority of the work. There have been a number of other smaller things. The March of Dimes has supported our work for the last several years. The Pew Award, actually, as I have told them in the past, the thing that's nice about it is not that it's a large amount of money or anything, but it's not, they don't tell you what to do with it. It kind of gives you a little freedom that you don't have with NIH grants, either to buy something or hire graduate students you couldn't have hired otherwise, and they don't really are not really looking to see that you do what you said you were going to do. I think they really want you to do something. They want you to do whatever you want to do with it. And there have been a number of other smaller grants that I've applied for. In general, what I feel now is it's such a lot of work to write an application that you might as well apply for a big one rather than a small one, because you have about the same chance of success. And you also find that you spend a large amount of your time writing grants, which I don't particularly enjoy, but it's part of the business. So while the lab was small, there have essentially just been these 2 grants that have supported it. As it's gotten larger, the postdoctoral fellows all have their own fellowships, which they write after they get here or before they come. So they're really essentially independently funded. The graduate students don't take a lot of funding, but I kind of get it off in one thing or another. And the real limitation we have is equipment, because the equipment is becoming so expensive. It's hard to get $170,000 for one microscope. So that I'm still working on, so how to figure that out. And now, we're essentially funded by those same sources. We have another grant from the Department of Energy, which I got 2 years ago at the beginnings of the Human Genome Project, and that's what a lot of what our lab is now doing is related to. And I see that the funding for that is increasing. So that we actually began doing that work before that became such a visible thing, such a publicly exciting area.
I see you're on one or two committees now.
I'm on a number of those review committees and committees. Since this is a new project and it's very controversial, I seem to want to get everybody's opinion about what to do.
What's your sense of talk just about how that is going right now? Since maybe 30 years from now, that
I'll tell you how it's going. It's very clear to those of us who are actually kind of in the nitty-gritty bench work that this project can really be done. There's no question. There's also no question in my mind that the rewards, scientifically and intellectually, are going to be far greater than anybody imagines. And they're among the kind of core of people who are actually in the doing of it. There's a great deal of enthusiasm. This is like I can imagine it was like the time before the first linear accelerators were started in physics. It's the beginning of a new way of approaching it. And we're very excited. I'm particularly excited about it. Not everyone shares that enthusiasm, not because they don't see the scientific benefits, it's because of the political and the cost involved. And what they see, and I can't say that I disagree, is that this will take a large amount of the budget for science funding, and it will put it into something that will undoubtedly take away from other people's projects. Now, a lot of the high-level administrators say that's not the case, that it really is a separate pot of money, but I don't think anybody is absolutely convinced of that. It is getting more difficult to fund research even without this project, and I think this may contribute to making it a little more difficult. On the other hand, if I were a clinician in the hospital and I was given a list of projects that I could say money should be put into based on what will come out to benefit my patients, I mean, I would put it into this project. There's no question about it. So there are a lot of areas of science that intellectually are very interesting, and they have the potential for generating things of great value. But this, there's no question it's going to generate things of great value. Yeah.
Is that argument going on in the committees that you're sitting on, or is that argument essentially over now? Is the other committees staffed with people who are believers?
I think this argument was going on several years ago, 2 years ago maybe. It's now, I mean, the project is going to be done. Unless Congress changes its mind, which is always a possibility, they're fairly convinced that this is an important area, that this magnitude of effort should go into it. And it's pretty much, not only is it decided that it will be done, there's a 5-year plan on how it's to proceed.
I use a Swansea metaphor and say you're very much at the coal face in this. So, how many players are there on, like you, on your level of competence? How do you number your peers as opposed to simply people working in the field?
Well, I guess the way I would answer that is, from all the meetings I've been to, there probably are 30 people or so who are as interested in this as I am, and kind of at the same level that give talks at all the same meetings, that have groups or are putting together groups and are generating enthusiasm to do it. And I'm not convinced they're all as focused, because a lot of them are, without naming names, are very senior scientists that are very well known in their field, but they're also doing a lot of other things. And in my mind, the people that are really serious, that clearly are going to do it, even if the government does cut back all the money, there's probably a handful or so. I think it's hard to gauge the numbers, because as we actually were involved in this long before there was any idea of how to fund it, because it was fun and it was an interesting approach and a new way to approach genetics. As the funding becomes apparent, a lot of other people kind of jump on, because it's clear that that's something you can get a grant to do. And I try to at least convince myself I'm not one of those. But I think it's important to do science because you're enthusiastic and interested in it, not just because you can get a grant to do it.
Where are the which are the other labs you would be looking at right now? Where is your hot competition?
Well, in this particular area, there's not as much competition directly. That is, people doing exactly the same thing, but people doing the same thing in different areas.
Okay.
And it's different because while it's competition for attention or for whatever, for public, for appreciation of one's peers, which is really what this amounts to, there actually is a lot of collaboration as we exchange things. The tools that you develop